Hello and welcome to the Pax Mundi show, where we'll be trying to shed some light on the new dark age, the global war on terror, and to the myths and misinformation about the global war of terror. Tonight we have a lot of news from the dark side about their dark deeds. And firstly, here in the UK Parliament this week, we're seeing the final reading of the current Justice Bill. Now, one of the things that the Justice Bill will introduce is the extension of the use of secret evidence in all court cases, that is, including civil cases, whereby one side will not have the right to see all of the evidence that the judge uses to decide the case, because someone has decided that that is against state interest. Evidence is currently used in immigration panels and deportation hearings. But, you know, clearly this is, you know, going to extend it further. This is another nail in our civil liberties and rights. Again, in the UK, there's been breaking news. The Mail on Sunday actually found documents that were evidence that there is actually US drones being flown from RAF bases here in the UK. This is the first time that this has ever been mentioned. The documents were from BOSS, the company who's actually managing these drones, the technical side. And this is RAF Waddington. That's in Norfolk, in the east of England. And there they are running at least five Reaper drones. These are the drones that carry the Hellfire missiles that are used to assassinate people. To know more about this, this is clearly, you know, secret and illegal, you know, warfare that's going on. We need to know and be asking our politicians what these drones are being used for. And hopefully that we'll hear more on that in the future. Again, the British government has been active. This is actually something I've referred to before in a previous show, whereby the British nationality, i.e. British citizenship, is now subject to arbitrary withdrawal and cancellation. And these decisions to withdraw your nationality, to deprive you of British nationality, these decisions are being made without any judicial process. These decisions are being made just by the discretion of the Home Office, of the Home Secretary, Theresa May. And we've seen an increase, although the legislation enabling this was originally passed in 2002, we have seen a massive increase in the use of citizenship withdrawal under the current Conservative and Liberal Democrat coalition. Often this withdrawal of citizenship is being done in coordination with US intelligence forces, and it is usually followed by that person's arrest, or in some cases it has been by their assassination. And there are currently 21 cases that have been identified whereby happened. In some cases, probably about 30% of them, these people were actually born in the UK. You know, they're not naturalized citizens, but they were actually born here. And then at the stroke of a pen and the click of a finger, a decision is made that they're no longer a British citizen. You may recall a case I've mentioned on a previous show of Mahdi Hashi, who was a young man, a British-born family from Somalia, and he was actually in Somalia. He'd previously been approached for over a long time. From the age of 16, he'd been approached by the intelligence services, by the ISI, to spy for them. Indeed, every time he'd travelled, he'd been pulled to one side on re-entry into the UK and asked, interviewed, coerced by the authorities to spy for them and to become an agent provocateur for the state, trying to talking about jihad and trying to entice others, his friends and colleagues, into incriminating themselves for the interests of the British state. So in order to actually escape this intimidation and pressure from the British intelligence sector, Mahdi went back to Somalia. He was busy working there. He's a trained social worker, and he was working for an NGO as a volunteer in Somalia when he was actually arrested illegally and taken to a nearby Djibouti, waited by US officials, and has now been taken back to the stand trial for allegedly being a member of Shabab. The allegations are that he was actually made into one of the chief commanders of Al-Shabaab. And these are just, you know, allegations, but, you know, now he's in a position where he's unable to, finding it difficult to defend himself. Definitely, when he was detained, his family did not know where he was for 5 weeks. They were told eventually by the British government that we've cancelled his citizenship and we will not do anything to help him. So there are a number of other cases. They usually do this when people go abroad, so that when they go on holiday or business, then they will cancel their citizenship, and the idea is that that person will then be stuck in whichever country they went to, and they will be unable to return to the UK. So whilst this is just happening to Muslims at the moment, I think we all need to be very clear, you know, that after the Muslims, you know, that will not stop there. You know, this arbitrary withdrawal of citizenship, effectively exile, it's like you know, the medieval sanctions of exiling your opponents, that will be used against other dissidents. So there you go. Our civil liberties are really under attack here in the UK. News from Guantanamo. You'll remember that when President Obama was elected, he promised to close Guantanamo. Well, you know, it's now 5 years later, and we're still waiting, and there's no sign of it being closed. Indeed, there are 166 prisoners remaining in Guantanamo, and although 86 of these prisoners have been cleared for release, they still have no prospect of imminent release. 56 of these prisoners are Yemenis, and although they've been cleared for release, they can't be released, it is stated by US, because there is a moratorium, an indefinite moratorium on their transfer back to Yemen. The Yemeni government is a very close ally of the US, and Yemen is engaged in a civil war between different ethnic factions. So these people effectively are faced with indefinite detention. You know, they're no risk to anyone. That's been agreed. None of them, you know, are being prosecuted. And they're stuck in this hell on earth, this Guantanamo. Now, again, another thing that's happened is that the conditions in Guantanamo have actually worsened. You would have expected they would have improved under Obama, but in fact, they've actually got worse. Prisoners complain of increased arbitrary searches, confiscation and destruction of personal items, desecration of the Quran, and increased violence against prisoners, including the recent use of rubber bullets against prisoners in the exercise yard. So all these factors have combined to motivate prisoners to launch a hunger strike. There are now over 100 prisoners in Guantanamo who are currently on the sixth week of an organized hunger strike. I've explained the motivations, the hopelessness, you know, of the situation of these people that is, driving this hunger strike. Once they are deemed to be, you know, at medical risk, then they are being forcibly fed through a tube, you know, strapped down onto a chair and then fed by a tube. And some of these hunger strikes have been going on for years. So one example is Tariq Bar-Oda, a young Yemeni guy who has been on hunger strike continuously since 2007. And every day he is forcibly fed by a tube. He continues his hunger strike because he states it is the only way that he can communicate to the world what it is to be unjustly detained, to be detained without hope of release. So the amongst the prisoners who are remaining in Guantanamo, there is one last remaining British resident. That is a guy called Shaka Amir. Now, Shaka was working as a voluntary teacher in Afghanistan in 2001, prior to 9/11 and the US-UK invasion, and he was subsequently sold, like many others, by mercenaries, Northern Alliance mercenaries, to the United States. There was a bounty, you may recall, of £5,000 per prisoner, and that is a lot of money in Afghanistan. Now, Shakir is suffering. Although he's been cleared for release for many years, there is no sign at the moment of him being released. What now? The background to Shakir is that he was an organizer of prisoner resistance and had been involved, you know, in helping his colleagues to organize the hunger strikes against their detention and to speak out against the prisoner abuses. And this is clearly why he's been singled out for continuous punishment during his 11 years of captivity. He is currently being held in an isolation block, which is known as 5 Echo. This was only recently identified. It's a secret prison within the Guantanamo camp. And despite being cleared for release back to the UK over 2 years ago, without any stated obstacle to his return, he remains in held captivity in isolation. Now, here's if you're interested, here's one way you can actually get involved. There is an e-petition on the UK government website. If you go to direct.gov.uk/petitions/33133, you'll find a petition there that you can sign calling for Shakir's immediate return to the UK. Now, this week, Green Party MP Caroline Lucas actually tabled an amendment to the government's proposed Justice and Security Bill that I was talking about earlier. Caroline Lucas's amendment was regarding the defamation of Shakir Amir. She stated, "The defamation of Shakir Amir is evidence of the immense power of the security services to say whatever they want about an accused man to devastating effect. Shakir has been cleared for release by the US government twice and yet remains in Guantanamo Bay, where he has been for 11 years. And, you know, he is completely unable to defend his reputation. These smears are being used to justify his continued imprisonment." Now, just once again, the e-petition, and there are currently 38,829 signatures. It's only open for a few more weeks. Let's see if we can make it at least 40, 50,000. So it's direct.gov.uk/petitions/33133. That's 33133. So, a little bit, that's the current news from the dark side. As you can see, the dark ones are being very dark in their deeds. And whatever they remember, whatever they're doing to the Muslims today, they'll be doing it to us tomorrow. Be very sure of that. Now, The main topic for this evening is about the UK's government's decision to deport Abu Qatada and the issues around that. Abu Qatada is a Muslim cleric who has been living here in the UK for several years, indeed since prior to 2001 and 9/11. He's been living here since the 1990s, when he fled arrest and detention in Jordan. Now, Abu Qatada, actually called Abu Qatada al-Filistinia, he is a Palestinian, and like many Palestinians, he grew up in refugee camps in neighboring Arab countries. Abu Qatada grew up in Jordan, and as such he had Jordanian citizenship. Now, he'd been living in the UK after he fled from Jordan, where he'd been critical of the Jordanian government. For your information, it is a royalty. It's the Kingdom of Jordan, and the king is the absolute ruler of Jordan. And this is a very vicious regime, which regularly uses torture against its opposition, and you know, is known to carry out arbitrary assassination. Indeed, some people may remember from the 1970s the Black September massacres, when the Jordanian government massacred thousands of Palestinian fighters and, well, just Palestinians, males, in the Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan. So that gives you a flavour of the Jordanian regime. Now, just to come to why I'm actually talking about Abu Qatada tonight, the Jordanian regime has been demanding that the UK send him back so that he can face trial there. Now, if he is sent back, he will face possible torture. He will almost definitely be convicted on evidence which has been produced by torture. This is the way that the Jordanian regime operates. Now, clearly this is in breach of all of our human rights legislation, our UK Human Rights Act, the UN Convention on Human Rights, and the European Charter for Human Rights. And therefore, Abu Qatada has appealed against his deportation to Jordan, and he appealed to the courts here in the UK, and they've all okayed his deportation, as they do now. He then appealed to the European Human Rights Court, and his case was recently heard. His case was turned down. This was just last week. The decision was that they would not interfere in any way with his deportation to Jordan. Now, this has been a very a very controversial case. There's been a lot of media coverage of Abu Qatada, often with pictures of him, probably from some while ago, because he's been imprisoned or in detention or on a control order for the last 10 years or more. And you may have seen a picture of him with kind of quite wild hair, and he's always called, you know, an Al-Qaeda fundamentalist. He's called, you know, that he's an Al-Qaeda preacher, he's a jihadi preacher, etc. And Mike was saying earlier, they continuously smear people. And this is done in the media day by day, until the mud sticks. If you throw enough mud, the mud sticks. And in the minds of the British people, Abu Qatada is clearly linked to Al-Qaeda, and is a dangerous person. Now, I was prompted to actually talk about this case tonight because of the overwhelming wave of Islamophobia, this rising tide of fear of Muslims, which is actually engulfing the UK. And my personal example of it this week was through my Facebook activity. I was I'm involved in a number of Facebook groups, like the Dark City Facebook group and Ashton Allotment Action Facebook group. Most of them are local groups here in Tameside, in England. And one of the groups that I'm involved in on the Facebook group for is the Tameside Green Interest Group. Now, this is a group of people who are concerned about issues like the environment, green issues, alternative energy, vegetarianism, animal rights, etc. Now, recently, just in the last couple of days, we received a Facebook invite on the Tameside Green Interest Facebook group from another neighbouring group, the People's Kitchen, who are based in nearby Glossop. Now, the People's Kitchen regularly hosts a communal meal, which is food cooked by volunteers. It is distributed and, you know, sold. It's a communal meal, good tasty food. It is vegetarian, and I've been along myself there before, and you know, it's a good evening. So I was really surprised then that suddenly one guy on the list responded to what was on the menu. Now, the menu stated delicious Indian food, and I'm sure it will be. His response was, "Has anyone noticed that this is Britain and not India?" I was actually quite gobsmacked by this, but it didn't stop there. He went on, "I would not personally eat Indian food, even though a lot of it is vegetarian, mostly because I can't stand the spiciness. My point is that we are too quiet and ready to take on other people's cultures at the expense of our own, and too politically correct in accommodating differences, which is why we are a soft touch for Muslims like Abu Qatada." So, really, this was quite shocking. I mean, this here is a generally a person who would probably consider themselves liberal, you know, but Clearly, they don't extend their liberalism to Muslims any longer. So on the issue of the food, I did point out to them that it was not actually the Indians who brought the food here to spread it to us, but it was in fact the British Raj who went out there to conquer India, to make it a part of the global British Empire, and brought back food products like curry, chutney, tea, etc., and introduced them into the British cuisine. Now, I did also respond that I would also defend the human rights of Abu Qatada like any other human being. Unfortunately, this guy went on to rant with another 80 posts, you know, bringing in all the examples of why we shouldn't extend human rights to Muslims, that because they abuse human rights, allegedly, therefore they should be denied them by us. He even ended up saying that Muslim terror suspects should be actually be used for medical research instead of innocent bunny rabbits. So that's the context in which you know, I decided to try and talk about this Abu Qatada issue, and indeed this rising Islamophobia in the UK, this fear of Muslims, where people actually fear that we're being overwhelmed by Muslims who are trying to convert us all, who will force us all to implement Sharia law. And it is really off the wall. The question that you have to ask is, how will they achieve this? You know, are British people just going to convert to Islam and allow them to introduce Sharia law? But there seems to be very little reasoning on this subject, and it is being conflated by the British media with all sorts of other issues, with the fear of Europe, for example. The issue of Abu Qatada's appeal to the European Court of Human Rights has been cited as European Union interference in British justice and British affairs. And the European Court of Human Rights is always cited as being an extension of the European Union. Now, in fact, it is absolutely nothing to do with it at all, and it predates the European Union, the common market, by at least 10 years or more. The European Convention on Human Rights was actually signed by Britain and most other European countries in 1953, and it was a reaction to the Second World War and the human rights abuses that were carried out by, well, mainly by the Axis powers, but by all during that war. Now, it was in order to prevent those sorts of things happening, the horrors of the Second World War, that we signed up to this convention. But now it is being used to incite this fear of European interference in UK affairs, even a xenophobia against Europe. Now, this discussion and other media that I've seen about this actually prompted me to look into the case of Abu Qatada and to have a look at what he'd actually been charged with, what evidence there was against him, and what his history was and what his political activity had been since he'd been here in the UK, because he's being cited as a jihadi preacher, etc. Now, as I've stated, Abu Qatada was a Palestinian. He was from Jordan, and he'd fled Jordan and claimed asylum here, which he was granted because the British government was and still is well aware of the torturing practices and human rights abuses of Jordan. But it's just that now we don't mind them because they're working for us and with us. Indeed, just recently, the British government revealed that they are actually training Syrian mercenaries in Jordan. We've got UK special forces training the Syrian jihadis, mercenaries in Jordan. So what I did was I actually had a look at what Abu Qatada's political activities had been. Now, for over 10 years, he's actually been either in prison. He was imprisoned in Long Laughing prison for a long time, in isolation, in detention there. Eventually he appealed his detention in Long Laughing prison, and he was then put on a control order. Now, the kind of conditions that he's been kept on were, he's been forced to wear an electronic tag. Sorry, this is actually while he's on a control order. Forced to wear an electronic tag. Forced to deliver a stated designated address. To remain at that address, save for 8 hours a week. He's only let out of his the address, his family home, for 8 hours a week. Now, he's only allowed out when the intelligence agencies, the police, tell him he can go out. He's not permitted to use any public transport. He's not permitted to go near in a car. He is only allowed to walk, and he is followed wherever he goes. He's only allowed to go to certain places, and then under further orders, he's actually not allowed to meet anyone except people that are authorized. His children, his family, aren't allowed to use the internet. They're not allowed to have a phone in the house. This is the level to which his activities have been controlled for the past 10 years. He's either been in detention or he's been under one of these control orders, and therefore he's not been able to do any of the things that he's actually accused of. He's not actually been able to make these controversial statements that he's accused of. The only evidence that has ever been presented as proof of his jihadi activities is actually claims by the Algerian government that he is a terrorist. And as a result of that evidence, he was put on a UN terrorist list. Now, at the time, you may recall I've spoken about Algeria before. Algeria is, again, it's a torturing regime, and it's a regime which carried out its own black operations, killing civilians and blaming them on Muslim fundamentalist groups. So Abu Qatada has made statements about this Algerian situation, and for that he's been labelled a terrorist. That, as far as he knows, is the only evidence against him. So what I'd like to do really is see if there's anybody interested out there, what you think, if you've heard about this Abu Qatada case, what you think about the increased paranoia that British people have about us being taken over by Muslims, that all Muslims are hell-bent on world domination and implementing Sharia law, and that this is something that is likely to happen if we continue to be liberal and to retain our civil liberties and human rights. So I don't know if there's anybody out there.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hello? I'd just like to say, I think it's maybe a distraction to take away from what's really happening, because I think we've got more to be afraid from the government.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, this is the thing, this is what they are trying to distract from their own activities. Yeah. They've set up this nice, easy target, the bogeyman. He's even brown, so we can, you know, distinguish him from everybody else. He's brown and he dresses differently, and, you know, and it's just a handy little bogeyman. But the things that are actually being done in the name of ridding ourselves of this bogeyman, it's so atrocious, it's vile. And that conversation you were talking about, Nigel, that you were having on that Facebook group.
Yeah.
And the guy actually turned around and said to you, you know, these people are destroying British culture. I would actually like to ask that man, or anyone who thinks along those lines, what they actually know of British culture beyond the corruption and the annihilation of British culture that has happened under this creeping velvet fascist regime which controls us all and has controlled us since the day we were born in this country. We know nothing of our own culture until we go digging in the history books.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Exactly so. Do you know, it's what they think of their culture that's excluding all of the other cultures of the world. We're all part of a big world, and the sooner we drop our own borders and start including everybody in, we can't, while there's an us and them, there's always going to be war. Until we realise that they are us. When they are us, then any problem is our problem. We always deal with our problems. It's other people's problems we can't deal with. Include them in us. When we find them in us, then of course we can come up with a solution to all these problems. Don't let all this stuff sneak in on you like that.
Yeah, so absolutely. I think it is clear to a lot of us that the Muslims are being used as the scapegoats. They are the current scapegoats. And we've seen this all before. We saw it, you know, under the Nazi regime. Then it was the Jews. We've seen it in other situations in Yugoslavia. It was the Muslims, the Bosnians, the Croats. In Rwanda, it was the Hutsis or the Tutsis. And what they're doing is clearly playing us off. They're deluding us, and they are redirecting our anger about what they are actually doing to us. The conversation with the chap on Facebook that I referred to earlier at one point. He said, well, the British people are angry. We're rightly angry. And these people are taking the piss out of us. And they can't see that they're angry at the wrong ones. Yes, they are having the piss taken out of them, but it's by the rich and powerful, by the banksters and the intelligence agencies and corporate interests. And those are the people that we rightly need to be angry about and to focus on. But unfortunately, they have produced this different, as you say, it's the alienness of Muslims, and that has divided our society. Muslim society has actually gone more conservative, and this tends to reinforce that. Indeed, in our own hometown here in Ashton-under-Lyne. I was brought up in Ashton-under-Lyne, and when I went to school with lots of Asian people, Muslims and Hindus, in the 1970s, and then generally the children of immigrants who'd been brought here, and they were actually integrating at that point, and that point continued. People were integrating. They were westernized, doing the things that we do, wearing the clothes that we were wearing, listening even to the music that we were listening to. And that process continued up to the 1990s. And then suddenly, after 2001... It started to reverse as the this division, as we started to marginalise Muslims in this country, they in turn became more defensive and actually became more conservative. So we now see in Ashton-under-Lyne, for example, people wearing a kind of conservative Muslim dress that even their grandparents would never have worn in Pakistan or India or wherever they came from. They're wearing a Saudi Arabian traditional dress.
One of the things you were discussing earlier on when you first began your show was all of these people on hunger strike in Guantanamo Bay. And you did touch on the way that people are force-fed. I don't think you quite iterated how vicious this force feeding is that happens to these innocent people that are being held indefinitely in these awful conditions. And basically what happens is they go on hunger strike, and as soon as there's any sort of medical indication that they're affecting their own health, then they are strapped down to a bench and a tube is forced up their nose. And this happens, I think it's two or three times a day, they're force-fed in this way. And it's really painful, as you can imagine, a tube shoved up your nose two, three times a day. And I just cannot imagine enduring years of that. I mean, it's just horrific. And all in the name of this bogeyman that has been created to distract us from the real bogeyman, who is the banker.
And the real bogeyman is the guy who's prepared to do something like that to another.
Indeed, anyone that would do that to
And anyone who wants revenge on all those people for behaving like that, they're also the bogeyman. And until they see that bogeyman in themselves and make peace with it, they're not going to be able to make peace with anything out there. Yeah. They're not going to be able to have peace.
So is it not then it's up to us to point out that they are the bogeyman, you're the one that's doing the evil deed, that's treating your fellow human in such an abhorrent way. And there was something else you touched on, entirely unrelated, it will come back to me at some point. This is just it's such a massive topic, isn't it? And it is so important because, as you say, people are being stripped of their citizenship in this country. This is British people that have been born here and brought up here, just like us, are being stripped of their citizenship and deported around the world to places where they're going to be tortured and in prison for indefinite lengths of time, with no idea that if they'll ever be released, if ever. I think when we come across fellow brothers and sisters on this island that are infected with this Islamophobia, which is being propagated by the media and in the schools and, you know, da-dee-da, then it is up to us to actually, as best we can, point out the reality of the situation for us and for those brown people or brown brothers and sisters. And let them know, actually, that, yeah, we're the bad guys or they're the bad guys or, you know, however you want to term it. And that until we wake up to the inhumanity within ourselves, we ain't going to do anything about the inhumanity that we perceive outside of ourselves. Yeah. Cool. Okay, rant over.
Absolutely. What we've got to do is to continue talking about these issues. I think that is the one thing we can do.
Yeah. Yeah, affect the consciousness.
And to try to reason with people. I think that is the problem, that a lot of the fear is irrational. It really is irrational. And the arguments that are used, likening people to Hitler, you know, we see always, we refer to them as the Nazis. And much just like it's used in, we don't see that we've become the Nazis. This time round, we are the Nazis.
Yeah.
And we're not defending anything. This British culture or this, what is it? If we're prepared to give away our own civil liberties and our own rights, in order to defend them, what have we got to defend?
Makes no sense whatsoever. And I think pointing out the irrationality of that is the only way forward, really. Because we can't affect the government and government decisions. Even that petition you were talking about, they've got a petition on a government website saying, shall we deport him or shan't we deport him? For fuck's sake, you know?
This petition is something the government didn't put in there. It was put there by people like us.
Okay.
So they give us these forums. I mean, it's like the sham democracy where we have a choice of, two or three parties who do the same thing. You know, they are all going along with the abuse of human rights and the global endless war on terror.
And so the only way we can affect that, which is the point I was making, is by talking to our brothers and sisters who think that this threat from Islam is real. Talking to them and pointing out the blindingly obvious, or what's blindingly obvious to us. And even if within the confines of that conversation, they don't get it there and then, you're planting seeds and you know, maybe those seeds will germinate, maybe they'll start to actually think next time they read something in The Guardian or see something on the BBC about, you know, Islam, big bad bogeyman, maybe they'll have a little germinating seed of truth and reality to actually draw their focus and prompt a little deeper reflection, maybe. That's the plan.
I have one little thing in my head that comes to me every time I hear about terrorism. And it's a mate of mine, Stevie, who kind of, he says it a lot. SWAT. this stands for the war against terror, I mean, terror in it, war in itself creates terror. So, you know, it is the irony of it. And so these people who have got this attitude, of course, I'm not even going to use that name for them. They are not racist. They are not prejudiced. They're stupid. I mean, okay, many people would want me to use the word ignorant. That's what they want me to use. But I'm not using the word ignorant any longer, because it doesn't sum it up at all. These people are not ignorant. Open a history book. As Deke said last night, open a history book. Any of them. You don't have to read it all. In fact, to coin exactly what Deke said, you can just look at the pictures. Just look at the pictures. You don't even have to read them right. Just look at the pictures. And you'll see it. Repeatedly making the same mistake and expecting a different outcome.
I suppose what they're actually doing is listening to the stories and reading the words in print and not seeing what's right in front of them, not seeing it glaringly obvious. That the voices in the head are too loud, you know. So, sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. We've got to somehow break this down, because this is really breaking our society apart. It really is dividing our communities. And the other aspect of it is that we have a criminalization of the whole Muslim community. This is being done by governments. They are criminalizing these communities. That's something I'd like to talk about another time. So on a future Pax Mundi show, talk about the British government's targeting of the Muslim community and how they've gone about that. Maybe we can extend that debate. Meanwhile, thanks to everyone who's been listening tonight. And I hope that you've enjoyed the show.
I have.
And, next week we can extend the discussion about Islamophobia. I'd certainly like to talk about the British government's very concrete plans for dividing and isolating the Muslim community. It's much like the Jewish ghettos. That's what we are seeing, a repeat of that kind of marginalization and containment and criminalization of a community. So once again, I'd like to thank you for tuning in, and hope you're going to be listening to the show next week, when we'll have more news from the dark side. And hopefully shed some more light on the myths and misinformation that we're being given about the global war of terror.